Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the deepening crisis in Syria following the bombings of hospitals by the Russians and the arrival of Saudi troops and warplanes in Turkey that could turn a regional proxy war into a Cold War confrontation, given the recent remarks by Russia's Prime Minister that we are rolling into a new Cold War. David Lesh, the Distinguished Professor of Middle East History at Trinity University and author of Syria, The Fall of Assad, joins us to discuss how serious peace talks are as the Russians, Iran, and Hezbollah encircle Aleppo, and whether an agreement to get food into besieged pockets of starving Syrians will be implemented. Then we'll speak with Erwin Chemerinsky, the founding dean and professor of law at the University of California, Irvine School of Law, and author of The Case Against the Supreme Court. He joins us to comment on the unseemly partisan battle that has erupted before Justice Scalia is to be laid to rest on Saturday, and the Republican obstruction that is expected to dominate this year's presidential race. We'll discuss whether or not the Republican Senate will cave under growing pressure to have a hearing and a vote on Scalia's replacement, or whether the toxic, crude, and vitriolic nature of much of the discourse amongst Republican presidential candidates will continue to drown out moderate voices and become the new normal. Then finally, we'll go to Mexico City for an update on the Pope's visit, where today he spoke at a stadium in Morales in the heart of the Knights Templar drug gang's territory, where they control most of the methamphetamine trade that feeds the U.S. market. Joan Grillo, who has reported on Latin America since 2001 for international media and is the author of Gangster Warlords, Drug Dollars, Killing Fields, and the New Politics of Latin America, joins us to discuss the brave stance the Pope is taking and his criticism of Mexico's clergy, who have grown too cozy with the rich and powerful. And joining us now is David Lesh, the Distinguished Professor of Middle East History at Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas, and author of 14 books, including Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad, and The New Line of Damascus, Bashar al-Assad and Modern Syria. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Lesh.
Good to be back, Ian.
And as bad as this Syrian war is, with all kinds of this patchwork of various rebels, factions, and then on the government side, you've got a depleted Syrian army, a statelet that's being defended. You've got Hezbollah, the Iranians in, and now you've got the Russians in. So you've got that patchwork on the ground. And there's also the overlay, I guess, of a proxy war between Iran and Saudi Arabia. But now, with the introduction of Saudi troops and warplanes into Turkey, is there a possibility that this could even get even more dangerous with a kind of Cold War overlay where Russia and America, after all, Turkey is a NATO country?
Yeah, it could really explode into all of those things. And the reason we're at this point is that, you know, for the first time in a number of years, we can actually say that one side could win. And, you know, the Russian intervention that began last September 30th, as well as help from Iran and Shiite groups in Iraq and Afghanistan, have helped to tip the scales on the side of the government after, you know, they were on the edge, it seemed, you know, last summer. It's taken a while to have this cumulative effect of the, particularly the Russian bombardment, continuing bombardment against non-jihadist Syrian opposition sites. But, you know, we're at a point right now where it seems that Aleppo is surrounded, and it might fall back into the arms of the Syrian government, which would certainly be a blow and perhaps a fatal one to the non-jihadist Syrian opposition. So this is a crucial turning point. Whenever you have these crucial turning points, you know, the vested partners in this game are going to make a lot of noise, or try to make a lot of noise. I think that's all it is. I can't imagine Turkey right now intervening in any sort of meaningful way in the north that would certainly cross paths with Russia. And their relationship is already frayed after the Turkey accidentally or purposely shot down a Russian jet last fall. And then Russia, of course, reacted with a number of sanctions, and there's still a bitter acrimony between the two countries. So, and on the other hand, you know, President Erdogan of Turkey is feeling himself in a somewhat desperate position, and he's in quite a pickle because any action he takes is bound to upset somebody, you know, or inaction. He could upset, of course, Russia, as I just mentioned. If he takes action against the Kurds, which both, ironically, the U.S. and Russia are supporting, that could upset both Russia and the United States. Yet, you know, his plans have all gone awry. You know, he hoped that Assad would fall, supporting the Syrian opposition, most of the Syrian opposition. He had hoped that the U.S. would certainly come to the Syrian opposition side much more than it has. All of that has fallen apart, and so I think they're making some interesting noises right now. I just don't think Saudi Arabia or Turkey, despite the bluster right now, are going to intervene in any sort of meaningful way other than stuff they're already doing in terms of helping the coalition with airstrikes, maybe some special forces. But, Saudi Arabia is tied down in Yemen right now. I just don't think they have the wherewithal, nor would they, I think, have the approval of the United States, either of those two countries, that could lead to a confrontation with Russia and cause the whole region to explode into not just a Cold War, but a hot war.
Right, and of course, U.S. reluctance only feeds the narrative amongst the Syrian opposition and amongst the Saudis, the Gulf, and the Turks that the U.S. is in some de facto alliance with Russia, that they're basically two-faced.
Yeah, I think the United States right now has acquiesced to Russia and its immediate aims. I think the United States made a decision some time ago that Assad, despite its mistaken assumption early on in the civil war that Assad would fall, that in fact he's not going to fall, and particularly with the Russian intervention, which makes it an established fact that the Assad regime isn't going to fall without any sort of aggressive U.S. Intervention, which is not going to happen. If it hasn't happened already, it's not going to happen now, and certainly not with the Russians there. And so I think from the U.S. perspective, the only thing we're, in a sort of Machiavellian way, is that they are agreeing reluctantly, and despite, saying on the surface that they're against Russian continued bombardment and all of this stuff, they're agreeing with the Russian and Syrian government plan to make this a binary war, basically getting rid of the non-jihadist Syrian opposition, or making them, impotent, so that all that's left is the Syrian regime versus the jihadist opposition, the Islamic State, and also Jabhat al-Nusra. And if that's the scenario, then I think most countries or the international community would again acquiesce to Assad staying in power, if not even support the Syrian regime in some sort of indirect way, if not directly, against these jihadist elements, because it's those jihadist elements that, since the Paris bombing and other bombings in Europe and even the United States, that's grabbing the news lines. And they're the ones that the United States has identified as the gravest threat right now, not the Assad regime.
And again, I'm speaking with David Lesher, a distinguished professor of Middle East history at Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas, and the author of 14 books, including Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad, and The New Line of Damascus, Bashar al-Assad, and Modern Syria. But, David, since you've met with Assad and interviewed him, I must say it's hard to get my head around the extraordinary cruelty of this man. I mean, maybe he's an ophthalmologist. He's a doctor, in a sense. Maybe he's not that personally sadistic, but the regime that he has appears to be. There were some rumors that he basically was told in other words, the people behind him are probably even worse, particularly his brother, who controls the Republican Guard. But, bombing hospitals and starving people to death, and, now that they're surrounding Aleppo, which is, I think, the biggest city in terms of population, even bigger than Damascus in the country, if they start starving those people, as they have been doing in Madaya, just mind-boggling that how much this guy's gotten away with. And there, of course, now the Syrian government is approving humanitarian access to some of these besieged towns, according to the UN. But, we have to condition ourselves into waiting to see the proof of that, don't we?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's very difficult to get into the mind of Charles Ossoff, particularly since the revolution started. And I even saw, you know, meeting him between on a regular basis between 2004, 2009, how he changed from the hoped-for reformer to someone who assimilated into the authoritarian system, and I think started to, you know, believe, you know, all the praise that the sycophants around him were heaping upon him. So, you know, I saw him change, and again, you know, his worldview and those around him have a completely different conceptualization of the nature of threat. They constantly think, and to some extent were correct, that they were the targets by the West, the United States, and regional powers for years, you know, preceding the revolution, and that the rebellion or revolution or uprising, whatever you want to call it, was just, you know, the latest chapter of this unending confrontation. Therefore, in his mind, and the mind certainly of his followers, not just surviving and staying in power and everything that means, I really truly believe he thinks he's saving the country and saving a way of life, particularly, you know, as he's compared it or contrasted it to, you know, groups such as the Islamic State or Al-Qaeda's affiliate in Syria, Jabhat al-Nusra. So, you know, I think he's seeing this as a necessary and unfortunate carnage, but it's also, you know, the authoritarian toolkit against insurgencies. You know, it's not, they don't just confront insurgencies, authoritarian regimes. They've actually been, you know, effective a good bit of the time against insurgencies if they repress it with a hammer instead of a velvet glove and just destroy the opposition. That doesn't necessarily mean there'll be long-term stability because people have long memories and they won't create sort of any love for the regime that puts down any insurgency with such carnage. But for the time being, you know, these authoritarian regimes, if they have an army that remains fairly loyal, and he has, and particularly in this case with outside supporters such as Russia and Iran, who are much more willing to support him than the West, the United States, and other countries were willing to support the Syrian opposition, they can win. And I think they you know, see at least a short-term victory in sight. And I think they feel, or he feels, arrogant enough probably at this point that he can stitch the country back together again, which I think would be a mistaken viewpoint. I think there has to be a great deal of change for Syria to continue, and even in a rump form. And I'm not sure the regime has really digested the fact that most of the Syrian people have gone on over the past 5 years without state power, without the regime, and therefore they have been empowered to expect certain things. Even if they, quote-unquote, lose this civil war, they necessarily won't go back to the status quo ante. And I think I'm not quite sure President Bashar al-Assad and his advisors have really recognized that fact and appreciated it.
Well, he does seem delusional if he thinks he's going to preside over a country. I mean, it's totally been destroyed, and half the population's displaced or left. And now that Aleppo is about to fall, it could get even worse in terms of starvation and death and destruction. And of course, in terms of the history of being defending against outside forces, there's no question that he was on the bad boy list as far as the U.S. is concerned. But my understanding is the Israelis always thought he was fine, that they could deal with him, you know. So it's not exactly clear, is it, that he was the heroic defender of the Syrian state?
Yeah, well, I guess he's hoping for that. But again, I think in those terms, he is mistaken. Unfortunately for Syria, you mentioned the destruction. I mean, if the war stopped today, it'd probably take 30, 40 years to get back to even where it was before the war, which is a kind of lower medium income country, a developing country with a lot of socioeconomic problems that led to the uprising in the first place. I think, you know, the regime and Bashar al-Assad are hoping that that if there is some sort of pseudo decisive end to this conflict, at least against the non-jihadist opposition, that its friends, as well as perhaps even the international community, realizing that he's the lesser of two evils, will come in and offer the type of reconstruction and developmental support that, you know, can put the country back on its feet again, at least in the short term, to allow it to take on the brunt of the battle against the Islamic State, along with the international coalition. Again, I'm not so sure that's going to happen. I don't know if many countries and their populations would consent to economically supporting the Syrian regime. But you know, the Russians and the Iranians have gone this far. I'm sure if Assad remains in power, they'll continue to support him, at least in some of the rump state that now exists under his control.
So has President Obama sort of swallowed the bitter pill of dealing with the Russians, even if he hasn't publicly made it clear? That's the sort of appears to be the situation. And of course, we see Kerry having a rather cold handshake with Lavrov, and they keep trying to get these peace talks going. And I guess you got to get Kerry's marks for trying. But the way I see it is that, you know, it's hard not to see that concurrent with the arrival of the Russians, and now, of course, they're using boots on the ground. The Spetsnaz have been involved in this battle for Aleppo. So they've really got skin in the game now. But concurrent with the arrival of the Russians has been this massive exodus of refugees to Europe. And you can't help seeing the connection there, that Putin is helping flood Europe with refugees, that is dividing Europe, polarizing its politics, giving aid and comfort to the European right and the far right, like Le Pen's party in France, etc., and Jobbik in Hungary. And this is putting pressure on the European governments, who Putin is putting the squeeze on in the hope that they will give up the sanctions against him over Ukraine and Crimea. So, I mean, that seems to be, at least that's my analysis of what's going on. And so what would your analysis
be? Well, as we've talked before, I mean, Obama came into office with a mandate, in his view, to get out of wars, not to get in wars. And he's tried desperately and made to stay out of sending boots on the ground into Syria. And the public, has not supported that. There are ways to get more involved in terms of material support and so forth and so on, more so than what he did. But he was always afraid of getting in a quagmire. And I think from the Obama administration's point of view, they see Syria much as the Carter and Reagan administration saw Afghanistan in 1979, 1980s, when the then Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan. They figured, well, that's been their sphere of influence for decades, much as Syria has been in Russia's sphere of influence for decades. It's not worth it for us, considering especially now what happened in Afghanistan, Iraq, to get involved in Syria any more than we have. I think the Obama administration could have done a much better job at managing expectations and also not making the fatal assumption that Assad was going to fall, and thereby calling for him to step down in August 2011. That was a mistaken assumption. So I think the Obama administration right now is just looking for good timing. I mean, I think they're willing to let the Russians do what they're doing, as barbaric as it is, to create a moment where a weakened, non-jihadist Syrian opposition will actually come to terms with an empowered Syrian regime. I think the non-jihadist Syrian opposition is much more resilient than most people think. But I think that's what the Obama administration is hoping for. So they're staying engaged in and encouraging a negotiating process, all the while Russia is using all this time to bludgeon the Syrian opposition, which they and the regime call terrorists, and by that they mean anyone opposing the Assad regime, including those that have been traditionally supported by the West, the United States, and our allies in the region. So I think we've, in essence, kind of wrung our hands from this and have realized that the Russians have taken the initiative and trying to stay engaged with the diplomatic process, hoping that something will come of this. I think for a diplomatic settlement or political settlement, there has to be parties at the table who are willing and able and engaged and vested in a process, as well as some rough symmetry. And in my mind, none of that exists right now. Now, there can be a peace settlement when one side is so bludgeoned and so weary of war that they'll just come to the negotiating table in a completely weakened position in order to survive. And I think that's what the Russians and the Syrian regime are hoping for. And I think the U.S. is kind of, at this point, can't really do anything about it.
Well, it just seems to me that Putin has played a weak hand very, very strongly, and we've played a very strong hand very weakly, and he's cleaning our clock. So that's the...
Yeah, I mean, Putin is, at fairly low cost, you know.
Yeah.
He's gained the initiative.
Europe's stuck with all those refugees. No, it's an extraordinary situation. I thank you for joining us, David Lesh.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with David Lesh, who's a distinguished professor of Middle East history at Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas, and the author of 14 books, including Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad, and The New Line of Damascus, Bashar al-Assad and Modern Syria. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the unseemly partisan battle that has erupted before Justice Scalia is to be laid to rest on Saturday. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Erwin Chemerinsky, who is the founding dean and professor of law at the University of California Irvine School of Law, with a joint appointment in political science. He frequently argues cases before the highest courts, including the Supreme Court, and his books include The Conservative Assault on the Constitution, and his latest book is The Case Against the Supreme Court. Welcome to Background Briefing, Erwin Chemerinsky.
It's a pleasure to talk with you.
And in terms of a case against the Supreme Court, it does seem that the death of Antonin Scalia and the fact that the Republicans, Mitch McConnell, the leader of the Senate, has vowed not to allow a replacement in this election year for the next 11 months or so, we're going to end up in many cases, with a tied court. And it sounds like the damage is being done to the court itself.
Well, first, I think it's premature to speculate as to what's going to likely happen the rest of this year or all of next year. To give an obvious example, if President Obama were to pick a very conservative individual, my guess is that Mitch McConnell and the Republicans in the Senate would be thrilled to confirm very quickly. I also think that if President Obama picks someone with impeccable credentials and a compelling life story, especially if it's a person of color, I think it's going to be very hard for the Republicans to be obstructionist and not hold hearings and not bring the individual to a confirmation vote. So I think right now there's a lot of posturing, but it's too soon to know what exactly is going to happen.
So you're almost suggesting Sri Srinivasan, aren't you, in a way? I mean, he got a unanimous approval by the Republicans to the appeals court, 97-0 vote.
I think there are a number of individuals who have impeccable credentials, compelling life stories, would be impossible for the Republicans to campaign against. I think you've mentioned one. I'd mentioned Tino Cuellar on the California Supreme Court, Paul Watford on the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, Loretta Lynch, the Attorney General of the United States, Jacqueline Wynn, a judge on the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. There are so many people who are superbly qualified and who I think the Republicans could not campaign against.
So in terms then of what is already happening now with the president today having a press conference at the close of the ASEAN summit out at Sunnylands in Palm Springs, he prefaced his remarks by again offering condolences to Scalia's family, and clearly there's been a kind of unseemly nature to the jumping the gun here with McConnell only hours, or perhaps even only an hour after the death of Justice Scalia was announced, throwing down the gauntlet. Now Chuck Grassley, who joined McConnell, has backed off a little bit and hasn't closed the door on hearings. As you've suggested, there's a lot of political posturing going on. But in terms of remembering the justice himself, I haven't noticed much comments on anything else except his positions on social issues and, of course, the Second Amendment issue, the Heller case. But there's a big lapse in the analysis of how much he seemed to always err on the side of the rich and powerful, and even went so far as to say that he had no problem with big monopolies in the United States.
Antonin Scalia was a very conservative justice. He was a conservative vote. He was a conservative voice on the Supreme Court. And 30 years of opinions, and in many areas he triumphed. You mentioned the area of gun control in the Second Amendment, but he was also in the majority of the court in striking down laws restricting campaign finance, especially in the Citizens United case. In other areas, he was less successful. He never triumphed in his desire to overrule Roe versus Wade. So the court did cut back on abortion rights during his tenure. He was never successful in getting the court to eliminate all affirmative action, though the court did cut back on the ability of the government to have affirmative action. He failed in his desire to block gay rights and to keep there from being same-sex marriage. And so it's a very complicated record. And then you look to areas like criminal law and criminal procedure, where usually he was on the conservative side, but not always.
Well, do you take these recent stories that are coming out suggesting that those that know him well and know him better say that he was actually interested in more diversity on the court, which would, given the argument now where the Republicans are throwing down the gauntlet because they simply don't want the conservative balance to change, they don't want the liberals to have a 5-4 majority. What do you make of those statements now in the press?
In his opinions, the justice, he emphatically rejected the importance of diversity, such as in colleges and universities. Of course, it would be ironic if he said that diversity matters on the Supreme Court when it doesn't matter in the rest of society. I've read statements such as from David Axelrod, where they said that Justice Scalia stressed the importance of diversity. I don't deny that he said it. I'm skeptical about how much he really meant it.
Well, what he did say on the record in relation to the Texas affirmative action case at the University of Texas was quite either consciously or unconsciously quite racist. He said, more or less suggested that African Americans shouldn't be going to these more exacting universities. They should go to less exacting colleges.
In the oral arguments in Fisher versus University of Texas on Wednesday, December 9th, Justice Scalia said exactly that. He specifically pointed to the sciences and said that the African-American students better off going to, and I'll use his word, slower schools. He received a great deal of criticism for saying that, including from me.
And do you recall him in any way replying or justifying that remark or walking it back?
He didn't. But it wasn't his style to pay much attention to critics in the press or to respond to critics in the press. Justice Scalia was very confident of his own positions and of his own abilities, and I don't think he felt the need to deign to answer people like me.
So just in terms of Heller, the Second Amendment case that most of the sort of analysts now doing the obituaries and comments on Justice Scalia cite as his greatest achievement, I'm curious to know how an originalist, as he claimed to be, could have come up with that decision, because in the Constitution, the predicate is the state shall have a well-regulated militia, and then the second part of it is that the citizens' right to bear arms should not be infringed. So I don't understand how that is the work of an originalist.
I think it's a mistake to say that that's his most important opinion or decision. I don't know that you could pick one out of his 30 years on the Supreme Court and anoint it. I think the reason it gets attention is the case that you mentioned, District of Columbia versus Heller, was the first time in American history that the Supreme Court ever found that the Second Amendment protected right of individuals dip guns. It was the first time that any law ever was found to violate the Second Amendment. How did he do it? The language of the Second Amendment is an enigma. It says a well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Justice Scalia said the amendment has prefatory language and operative language. Those were his words. He said the operative language is the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. He said prefatory language can't be used to undermine the meaning of the operative language.
Well, but one of the things that disturbs me, and there hasn't been a lot of reporting on it, and I did speak a little while ago with Elizabeth Wydra, who follows the Supreme Court and seems to sit in on most of the big arguments. And many of these cases, and I'm not sure Heller, but I know Heller was the result of what they call Supreme Court shopping. But there's one particular conservative group in Washington, I think the fellow's name is Gross, that runs it, that has managed to get an extraordinary number of these cases before the Supreme Court, all of which invite these tectonic changes. And I think the latest of which is the affirmative action case at the University of Texas. I think also the case that came out here of California that could deal a death blow to public sector unions, the case involving an Orange County school teacher, so about union dues. So do you follow that phenomenon of Supreme Court justice? Because it's very suspicious to me that an inordinate number of conservative decisions are basically slipped into the court by a very small group of activists.
Do not slip in. I think we've got to be careful here. Both liberal and conservative advocacy groups bring litigation with the goal to change the law. If it's a lawsuit by the ACLU, we would not say it slipped in. It's a law reform effort. I think that the efforts that you mentioned, like Fisher, like Friedrichs about the rights of non-union members, are efforts by conservative groups to change the law in their direction. So I have no problem with public advocacy groups trying to change the law in the way that they want. And the reality is that there are conservative ones and liberal ones.
Well, the big one, of course, was the hit movie on Hillary that became Citizens United. So I guess what you're saying, Erwin Chemerinsky, is that it's all fair in love and war and politics, and the race goes to the swiftest.
Well, what I'm saying is that both liberals and conservatives bring litigation to change the law in the direction they favor. My definition of the big one was the NAACP brought the lawsuits that culminated in Brown versus Board of Education. And you're right, conservatives brought the lawsuit that led to Citizens United. But all of this then takes us back to why Justice Scalia's passing matters so much for the future of the court. There are four liberal justices on the court. There are four conservative justices on the court. Justice Kennedy votes with Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito and Thomas much more than he votes with the liberals. And so this is the possibility, having a fifth progressive justice on the court. There has not been a time in my career, and I graduated law school in 1978, where there have been five more liberal justices on the court than we would have now, assuming President Obama can get a liberal to replace Justice Scalia.
But are you okay with the labels themselves, Erwin Chemerinsky, the liberal versus conservative split? Because my understanding is that there really aren't any liberals on the court in the mold of Thurgood Marshall and William O. Douglas, that the liberals that we refer to tend to be more centrist than the liberals of old, whereas the conservatives are more conservative than the conservatives of old.
I think that's a fair characterization. I mean, obviously, it's a continuum and not just two possibilities. I don't think that there's anyone on the current court as liberal as Thurgood Marshall or William Brennan or William Douglas, though I think Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Sonia Sotomayor come very close to that. I think Elena Kagan and especially Stephen Breyer are a little bit more towards the center than there. On the other hand, I think that in Justices Alito and Thomas, you have justices as conservative as anyone who has served on the Supreme Court. And Justice Scalia was there with them, too.
But what about this issue that's come up over how most of the justices are recruited out of the appeals court? And that's, of course, what they're talking about now with a number of them, including the Indian-American who we mentioned, Sri Srivanasan. Of course, the great virtue of the justice who was appointed by Ronald Reagan, the first woman to the court, she, of course, had legislative experience in the Arizona legislature. And my understanding is that there is a sort of they're all coming out of the same pool, in other words, out of the appeals court, and they've all gone to either Harvard or Yale Law School.
Well, eight of the nine justices who were on the court prior to Justice Scalia's passing had been federal court of appeals judges before going on the Supreme Court. Only Elena Kagan did not come from that mold. Justice Kagan was, for 1 year, the Solicitor General of the United States, and before that, the Dean of Harvard Law School and a law professor. This is a relatively recent phenomenon. We can go back not that long ago to Richard Nixon appointing Lewis Powell, a lawyer from Virginia, former president of the American Bar Association, and William Rehnquist, an assistant attorney general. Of course, you mentioned Sandra Day O'Connor. She was a court of appeal judge, but in the state of Arizona. You are correct that of the current justices, all went to Harvard or Yale, except Justice Ginsburg started at Harvard and then transferred to Columbia when her husband got a job in New York. All of the justices grew up east of the Mississippi, except for two. Only one was living west of the Mississippi at the time of appointment. So there's a need for more geographic diversity, more diversity in terms of life experiences.
And what about political experience, knowing that what the legislature is about so that the decisions may not – the argument is that at least Sandra Day O'Connor understood how legislatures work, and there's been an argument that quite a lot of these decisions are devoid of an understanding of the realities of politics.
One of the most humbling experiences I ever had was when I ran for election to an office in the city of Los Angeles. And I remember the morning of the election saying to my wife, you know, my name's on the ballot today, and I might get only two votes, mine and yours. And she looked at me and said, why are you so presumptuous to assume you're going to get my vote? And there is some benefit to having people on the Supreme Court who had to go before the voters and stand for election. There is some benefit to having people on the Supreme Court who have been part of the legislative process and have an understanding of how it really works. I think there's also a real benefit of having people on the Supreme Court who have been trial lawyers and trial judges to what really goes on in the lower courts. I think it's a court that needs to have quite broad array of diverse experiences and differing backgrounds. There's only nine of them.
Well, thank you again for joining us here today, Owen Chemerinsky.
Such a pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Owen Chemerinsky, the founding dean and professor of law at the University of California, Irvine School of Law, with a joint appointment in political science. He frequently argues before the Supreme Court, and his books include The Conservative Assault on the Constitution, and his latest is The Case Against the Supreme Court. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back and go to Mexico City for an update on the Pope's visit. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now from Mexico City is Joan Grillo, who's reported on Latin America since 2001 for international media, including Time Magazine, Reuters, CNN, the Associated Press, PBS NewsHour, the Houston Chronicle, CBC, and the Sunday Telegraph. His first book, El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency, was translated into five languages and was a finalist for the Los Angeles Times Book Prize. And his latest book just out is Gangster Warlords, Drug Dollars, Killing Fields, and the New Politics of Latin America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joan Grillo.
Always good to be here.
And this happens to be a day we're talking, Joan, where Pope Francis is in Morelia, in the Mexican state of Michoacán, which you've visited. You've broken bread, I guess, to some extent, with the Knights Templar drug gang that's infamous for the methamphetamine trade, all of which is basically conducted here in the United States, feeding a massive market of methamphetamine here in the United States. And you describe their armaments and their attitudes, etc., that at one point one of them was going to shoot you because he thought you were a DEA agent. So it's interesting, given your experiences, Joan, that the Pope is taking this issue on front and center.
Yeah, I think it's quite a nice sign that the Pope is going to these places. In recent years, most world leaders, most powerful figures, when they come to Mexico, will only go to the very safest places with a lot of security. They'll come to Mexico City, they'll go to a conference in Cancun, to Monterrey. But it's, you know, a long time since we've seen world leaders going to Michoacán or to Ciudad Juárez, where he'll go tomorrow. So it's quite nice to see that he will go to these places, that they're still on the map, and that he wants to reach people in these places and address their needs, these problems that they face of violence, of corruption, of disappearances, and all these very, very heavy issues that have been plaguing Mexico for the last decade.
Well, at the big stadium in Morelos in Michoacán today, as the huge crowd waited for the Pope, they counted down to 43, from 1 to 43 in massive unison. And, of course, 43 is the number of the missing students. So that's clearly still an open wound.
Yes, certainly. There's been a whole series of horrific massacres in Mexico, and I did one timeline, you know, putting together to get the data of all of these worst massacres. You see them very clearly since 2010 onwards, that we start seeing these really crazy massacres happening in Mexico. In 2010, there was one where 56 people were thrown down a mine in Taxco, actually quite near Iguala, where that happened. And in some of the worst incidents, we saw fields with 193 bodies, you know, even a series of fields in the state of Durango with hundreds upon hundreds of bodies. So the Iguala attack wasn't the biggest or the newest, but it became emblematic of all of this violence in Mexico. There was a reaction to it for various reasons, because that they were student teachers, because the police were so heavily involved, because it was in Mexico, near close to Mexico City, or perhaps because the moment had just come and it was just like that moment, you know, that they happened and it hit people. And hundreds of thousands of people took to the streets. And it's still a rallying cry for many in Mexico, symbolizing injustice, violence, repression. Now, one thing is, it's still very sensitive, the debate about this attack. And for some people, you know, it really symbolizes the government attacking people. And the fact you have police involved with drug cartels, but people really believe this was something organized from higher up and an act of repression against people from the government. And other people see it more as this issue of the criminal groups attacking society from the bottom, in a sense. So still quite controversial what it means, how we should interpret that. But yes, certainly still an open, bleeding wound in Mexico.
And again, I'm speaking with Joan Grillo, who is in Mexico City. He's reported for Latin America since 2001 for international media, and his latest book is Gangster Warlords, Drug Dollars, Killing Fields, and the New Politics of Latin America. It does seem, though, that Pope Francis is going out of his way to scold Mexico's priests and bishops in particular, calling them sort of gossipers, career-minded and aloof, and admonishing them to stand with their flock and offer prophetic courage and to put aside their comfortable lives and become pastors with the smell of their sheep. So what is it with Mexico's church hierarchy? Are they too comfortable with the political establishment and the economic establishment? And I take it that would include a lot of these people who've gotten rich off dirty money.
Yeah, well, certainly the church in Mexico is a many-headed beast, and you see different manifestations of the church here. So you see some priests on the ground who are already doing exactly what Pope Francis is asking. There was a priest in Michoacán State called Gregorio López, known as Padre Goyo, who used to really speak out against the Knights Templar cartel and give mass in a bulletproof jacket and was really, you know, saying, I have to protect and fight for my people. Another guy, Padre Solalinde, who was really helping migrants and had a migrant shelter and had to take on the setas who would harass and extort and kidnap migrants. So on that side, you have people doing what Pope Francis is asking, but there's also many bishops and priests who are more comfortable in these hierarchical positions, and there's been a problem where some of these churches or some chapels have been built with the money from drug traffickers. You know, the church admits this. It says in the church newspaper in Mexico, it said back in 2010, you know, we've got these concerning reports of drug traffickers paying for chapels in certain areas. This is a bad thing. So as well as the drug trafficking money, you know, you have an issue with the church. You know, it's a big question of what role the church should play in modern Mexico and in modern societies around the world. And what Pope Francis is trying to do is have a more engaged church, realizing that if the church is not more engaged, if priests are not really reaching out to people, many will leave the church and join evangelical Christianity or many other different religions, or leave, you know, all religions altogether. So he wants to try and change this in the spirit of being with people and not being, you know, a church of bishops living these kind of, you know, these extravagant worlds and the poor people below them.
So in terms of the Pope's security, though, when you talked about the priest in Michoacán who had to wear a bulletproof jacket, from what I've seen of these pictures of the Pope traveling around in the Popemobile with thousands of people lining the streets, and it seems like the sides are completely open.
They are. This is an interesting point. I mean, he said publicly he didn't want to have armored cars, you know, bulletproof vehicles in this. He wanted to be open to touch the people, to reach the people, which is, you know, quite concerning. You can see people around him being quite concerned with this issue. And, you know, and he'll break away from the red carpet. There'll be a red carpet and he'll walk off it and just, you know, and like to touch people and talk to people and that kind of thing. It was an interesting comment he made after finishing a mass in Ecatepec, in a town to the north of Mexico City, to about 300,000 people. And he said afterwards, remember to pray for me, which was kind of an odd thing to say. I mean, pray for him, he's okay, or don't know quite what that meant. But yeah, I think there's certainly no concern that he is very open. You'd hope that there's simply nobody with the motivation or will to want to attack the Pope, where we can carry on this tour fine and leave and go safely back to Rome.
Well, of course, the Ariana Felix gang from Tijuana some years back, when they laid an ambush at the Guadalajara airport for Chapo Guzman's gang, they shot the papal nuncio by mistake. They machine gunned him.
Yeah, or maybe it was by mistake, or maybe it wasn't.
Exactly.
It still remains a very controversial issue. There are a lot of conspiracy theories there about, you know, did that church figure have information about government corruption? Or no, there's just a lot of conspiracies bouncing around. Or maybe they simply did shoot him by mistake, but they shot him, murdered him in the airport, and then got on the plane and flew from Guadalajara to Tijuana. So, yeah, there has been a history, and there have been clerics attacked here before. There was a Ugandan priest who was working in Guerrero State in 2014, and he was murdered, and his body turned up in a mass grave there. So some people will not, some gangsters, some killers will not respect the cloth as being a reason not to attack these people. But yeah, the Pope is at a whole different level. He does have security guards around him. There is a whole bunch of security guards there next to him. He's not completely open.
So tell us then about the work that you did in getting this new book together and researching it, Gangster Warlords, Drug Dollars, Killing Fields, and the New Politics of Latin America. Because it's not just Mexico that you focus on, even though you're based in Mexico City and have been there for about 15 years. Nevertheless, this is a broader landscape that you're covering here. This is, you know, I mean, after all, for example, Guatemala is, for all intents and purposes, a narco state. Venezuela, in many ways, is becoming a narco state because the government is collapsing there. So let's start with that. What are the worst countries in terms of the power and corrupting power of the drug cartels over governments?
So, you know, in the 15 years I've been working in Mexico and been traveling and covering Latin America in this period, you know, I soon, you know, realized this very clearly. This, what has happened in Mexico in the last decade and this violence is not unique to here in Mexico. This is a common thing happening across the region. And you can see very similar patterns and very similar ways these cartels organize. You know, in Mexico, they're known as cartels. In Colombia, they're known as cartels. In Central America, we talk about gangs. In Jamaica, posses. In Brazil, commandos. And all of these words don't really, you know, are not really accurate in a way of really describing what these organizations are. They're kind of a mix of organized crime, but also paramilitaries, kind of warlords, militias. And on the other side, they have this kind of rock star status. They're leaders of this rock star status. So you see this pattern across the continent. Now, it's worse in some places than others. I say that there's about 9 or 10 countries across Latin America and the Caribbean which in all or in significant parts of the countries have some serious problems with these crime groups overwhelming the government, overwhelming society. And that goes right from Mexico, Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, over to Jamaica, Trinidad, Tobago, down to Colombia, Venezuela, Brazil. And then as well as that, you get another 9 or 10 countries which also have reasonable problems as well, not on the same level, but have, you know, also significant concerns. So you look at what's happening in somewhere like Ecuador, somewhere like Dominican Republic, somewhere like Puerto Rico, and you can still see signs of this organized crime and these same issues, but not on the same level. And then maybe there's about 5 or 6 countries in the continent which don't have this problem. So Chile, Uruguay, Costa Rica, you know, which largely do not have the same level of problems.
So how much is this the phenomenon that's often said in the drug world in terms of their, you know, the Godfather phrase of, we're going to make you an offer you can't refuse. The old adage, it's either a bullet or a bribe, silver or lead. Is that essentially what it comes down to, that countries either have to resist this temptation? I mean, when you have low-paid police, you have endemic corruption, it does seem it's next to impossible. And what the drug gangs do is not only do they target the few honest people who want to take them on, they also have killed about 125,000 people in the last decade in Mexico alone. And that's got to be a huge deterrent. And I think, wasn't it recently where they mentioned somebody that it was a hero in terms of the standing up to the drugs cartels? And one of the government officials mentioned that person's name. I'm trying to remember who this was. I don't have the exact memory of it, but I know that that cartel went out and killed that person's entire family. So are you familiar with what I'm talking about?
That might be going back to 2009, to one of the Marines who was involved in killing
Beltran
Leyva, and was given a hero's funeral in the cartel when it murders his whole family in Tabasco State.
Yeah, that was the incident. The Marine hero that the government made a big deal out of, and then they went and killed his entire family. So I guess that's just gives you a picture of what honest people are up against in these countries.
Yes, certainly. When you get down to the ground level, you see this difficult situation all the time. Let's look at the situation of prison guards, for example. In Mexico, that's a big deal right now. There was a horrific massacre in a Mexican prison with 49 deaths just last week. We saw Chapo Guzman escape with, you know, almost certain some kind of form of support from prison guards. Now, you look at prison guards who are often corrupt, but they're a very tough job. You know, you go into these prisons, you see what they're like. You see the people you're dealing with. And the prison guards know that if they don't work, if these prisoners say to them, you're going to help me, you know, I know you're working the shift tomorrow, and you're going to turn a blind eye while we're going to get this material into prison. And if they don't help them, these guys know that their families could be murdered. There was one case when a bunch of prison guards who refused to help the Zetas in Matamoros State finished their, in Tamaulipas, in the city of Matamoros, in Tamaulipas, finished their shift, left the shift to the prison, and the Zetas were waiting outside for them, got each one of them and murdered them and dumped their bodies. So, you know, these people are scared if you leave work, not just scared like in some American prisons where you might be scared of what the guy will do to you there, but they're scared of what happens when they leave work. The guy could be waiting for them outside the prison. The guy could go to their house and murder their entire family. So obviously there's huge pressure. But if you look at the bigger picture, there's this issue of corruption. In some moments, it's even beyond corruption. Corruption is not a word even sufficiently strong to describe what's going on. You get a capture of elements of the government apparatus by criminal organizations. And that's what you see again and again in parts of Latin America, particularly in parts of Mexico, but in other places as well. And that is a very scary thing. When you get the fact the mayor is controlled by the cartel, or a governor is controlled by a cartel, the state police chief is controlled by a cartel, it becomes a very frightening situation. And that's one of the concerns of what we're really dealing with. But yeah, a real central part of this whole issue of what's going on in Latin America and the Caribbean and what this violence means is how the nation states work in the 21st century and the struggle to make functional nation states in the 21st century. This is a problem that many of the nation states in Latin America and the Caribbean do not have the monopoly of violence or the monopoly of waging war and administering justice in their territories. They cannot really control these territories. And that's one of the really big things at the core of all of this.
Well, John Grillo, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Always great to be here.
And again, I've been speaking with Joan Grillo, who is a reporter based in Mexico City, who has reported on Latin America since 2001 for international media. And his latest book just out is Gangster Warlords, Drug Dollars, Killing Fields, and the New Politics of Latin America. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.